the streets are screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, as always, the economic news of the week looks interesting and more interesting as the days go by. Well, what are we going to talk about today? Well, one significant development, very clearly, is that interest rates in the U.S. continue to rise, in fact, at a faster pace this year than earlier parts of this year. I'm talking about even before the Fed raises its rate, we see the 10-year bond rate escalating well over 3% threshold on its way to a much higher level, probably, with significant implications for the U.S. and the global economy. As far as the U.S. is concerned, you know, we talk about rates affecting housing, the housing sector, and, of course, the auto sector. Rates are already going up 4.5% for autos, which were already slowing down, and now they're going to slow down rapidly. So the auto sector is in deep doo-doo. One of the reasons maybe why Trump is focusing on that with negotiations with Mexico and Canada, to help the auto companies, and also focusing on that with the past negotiations with South Korea and now with China. Autos are at the center of these negotiations because the industry is about to take a deep dive. Okay, so rising rates have a negative effect on the auto industry and also on the construction industry. We're also already seeing housing flattening off. Two important sectors of the economy. Students are about to get raped a little bit more here with student loans rising. So all these effects, you know, and businesses borrowing, of course, particularly those that have been borrowing deeply in debt with junk bonds and so forth in the oil sector, the shale sector, those drillers are in trouble here, loaded up with debt going into the next cycle. And of course, as we said last week, started to talk about the impact on rising interest rates on emerging market economies. As interest rates rise, the dollar rises. And if the dollar rises, then other currencies decline, because exchange rates are always one currency to the other. And you can really see the writing on the wall with Argentina, Turkey, and a few others now beginning. Argentina in a recession, and Brazil in a recession, clearly already. And now you've got a collapse of their currency. So investors there in Argentina want to get out of their currency, the pesos, and get into dollars so that they can buy rising rate securities in the U.S., dollar-denominated securities. And when they do that, they dump their currency on the market. You've got an excess supply on the market of Argentine pesos, and that reduces the price of Argentine pesos. And at the same time, if you're using that cash to buy dollars, drives up the demand for dollars and raises the price of dollars in international markets. You get this big spread. And with that spread, even more so, you get falling Argentine currencies here. So that's what's happening, you know. And keep in mind, what is Argentina? Argentina is just a market for U.S. speculators and their indigenous elites to rape the country and make money. And that's exactly what they did. You know, there was a fight since between U.S. Hedge funds and Argentina coming out of the last crisis in Argentina. And they the hedge funds demanded payment, And Argentina said governments, Kirchner and others before, said, no, you raped us, we're not going to pay it. And a 12-year fight went on, well, more than 12, almost 15-year fight. And finally, the capitalists and their friends in Argentina took over again with the Macri government. And what did the Macri government do? First thing it did was pay off the hedge funds. Yeah. In other words, took money that should have been spent in Argentina and paid off the hedge funds. Well, why did they do that? Because then they could go and borrow again from the New York banks and hedge funds even more. So they paid off in order to borrow more. And of course, the investors who borrowed more are skimming off the top and getting themselves richer from these loans from the New York banks. So that's really how they play the game, you see. The indigenous elite plays the game with American bankers and financial institutions at the expense of their domestic economy. Well, what are they doing now in Argentina? They're raising their interest rates to try to stem the capital flight that's occurring because of the collapse of the pesos and the rise of the dollar. Well, how much has the dollar risen in Argentina, or how much has the peso fallen? Well, it's almost in free fall. If you look at it, it's fallen 35% here in about 6 months or so, 23% just since January, and 17% just in the last month. So it's accelerating. The collapse is accelerating, and that has caused the Argentine Central Bank to raise its interest rates to try to stem the accelerating capital flight out of the country. But of course, when they raise their interest rates, what do? They slow down their real economy. Right now, interest rates, the base rate in Argentina is 40%, 4-0. Just imagine if we had 40% interest rates in the US. That would be the benchmark rate by the Fed. And then, of course, you'd probably pay about 50% for a home loan and about 60%, 55% for an auto loan. Well, that would shut down the entire economy. Well, that's what's happening in Argentina. The economy will be shut down fairly soon. But why are they doing that? Well, to protect the value of the investments of their investor class. You see, if you got deflation going on in the currency, they're losing the value, the profits, as that deflation occurs. So to prevent the deflation from occurring or to slow it down, what they do is they raise interest rates in that country. So they're just protecting the profits and the returns of the wealthy here at the expense of the rest of the economy and the rest of the society. That's Argentina. Well, the same thing's kind of going on in Brazil as well, already in a recession. There we had an U.S. Assisted coup a couple years ago, a year or so ago, just as Argentina occurred similarly, part of the U.S. whole strategy to take back Latin America economically. And of course, the Brazilian real has dropped 13% against the dollar, not as great as 35% with the Argentine peso, but still pretty significant. We see the same thing going on in Turkey. An 18% collapse, 8% just in the last month. Even the euro is beginning to fall in relationship to the dollar. So as long as the Fed keeps raising interest rates, which it will do, you're going to see currency exchange rates have a widening gap, which means as the dollar appreciates, these other currencies will collapse, and with it, will collapse their economies. So we're on the cusp of an emerging market crisis, similar to what almost appeared in 2013 when Ben Bernanke, the chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve, threatened to raise interest rates, caused a lot of consternation in emerging markets, and especially with U.S. multinational companies doing business in emerging markets. So Bernanke backed off. Well, what's the connection with multinationals to all this? Well, if they're doing business in these countries and the currency is collapsing, well, then the value of their profits are collapsing in those countries. And they don't like that, you see. So they put political pressure on the Fed and the US government to slow down the rate hikes, right? Slow them down. It's a contradiction here for the Federal Reserve. You got inflation beginning to rise in the U.S. Supposedly raising interest rates will slow that down, dampen that inflation down. But then you have the impact on multinational corporate profits. That's the result of the exchange rate effects of all this. So we'll keep watching this closely, particularly those key countries. And Latin America is now experiencing it's a made in the USA recessions, and that's going to deepen. Okay, so let's go back to some other topics here. We talked about the U.S. rate increase, Federal Reserve raising interest rates, and that's already being reflected in Treasury bond rates. When the Fed raises interest rates, it influences the what's called the federal funds rate, but that's a benchmark rate, you see, and all the other rates go up in turn. Well, in large part, the rise in the mortgage bond rates, the 10-year rate, which is kind of a quasi-benchmark, is a reflection of expectations that the Fed will keep raising the federal funds rate. We got a Fed decision coming up this month again in June. Almost for certain they'll raise rates again. And what they're doing is the bond markets are baking in that increase already. So we're going to see the drift up of the 10-year rates. Now, the shorter-term rates are rising even faster. If you look at Treasury 2-year bills and bonds and 5-year even, they're rising even faster than the 10-year rate. You can look at 90-year Treasury bills and so forth. All of these are ways that the Fed raises rates to raise money. You see, when we say the Fed raises rates, it means it's raising interest rates as it tries to induce buyers of its T-bonds and bills. And the Fed has a massive amount of money it has to raise this year because of the tremendous U.S. budget deficits, $1 trillion plus in the coming year, and $1 trillion every year, as long as you can see, largely due to the Trump tax cuts, as I've been saying, and the rise in defense spending, creating huge deficits that the Fed has to somehow sell bonds to raise the money to pay for the deficit, you see? And that's really what's going on now with the Fed raising interest rates. And it will continue as long as it needs to raise rates to cover the sale of bonds. Well, it's selling bonds by the billions and tens of billions almost every week now. And the last bond sale here past week, it could not sell. People did not buy the bonds. Investors did not buy the bonds at the rate that the Fed was offering. So the Fed now has to raise its offer, i.e., rates go up. So it's the deficit that's driving these rate increases by the Fed, and in turn, slowing down autos and construction in the US and causing havoc in emerging markets with capital flight and currency depreciation. Oh, big contradiction here, right? They want their tax cuts. The rich in this country want their tax cuts, and they got them. Well, now they're going to have to face the consequences of the deficits and all that that means with rising rates and collab and rising dollar. They don't care. They want to take their money and run. You see, that's the difference between American elites today. They're really decadent, and they're not as clever and as smart as they used to be. You see, the quality of the leadership of the capitalist class in this country has really deteriorated in the last several decades. They used to look at the big picture, and they used to look at, well, we got to make sure that the rest of Americans sort of have a taste and come along with our policies, but they don't care anymore. What they want is gather as much as they can, and even at the expense of taking it from other American citizens. Yeah. And that's what's going on too, the quality. And you can see the political quality. Republicans let this guy, Trump, in the hen house, right? You let the fox in the hen house, and now they're trying to deal with him. Well, they're doing pretty good here. They got what they wanted so far on the tax cuts. I predict they're going to get what they want on the trade deals. And as far as what Trump wants on immigration and all that, he's been pretty much stymied. So if you look at the results, the traditional capitalist elites behind Trump and behind the government are really winning in dealing with Trump, I think, and they will continue to win. Well, I predicted that right back when he was first elected, that that would be the struggle within the Republican Party and to some extent the Democratic Party on the fringe there involved. The quality of the leadership and therefore reflected in the policies of American economic policymakers has really declined. And it's a reflection of the decline here in general in American economy and society as a global leader, right? Okay, so we're going to continue to see these rate increases. The 10-year T-bond at over 3% already is at a 7-year high and going higher here. And now this raises an interesting issue worth talking about, which I'm just going to offer to you, and we'll come back to it at the end here. And that interesting issue is what's called the yield curve. You ever hear that? The yield curve. Well, a lot of talk now, beginning, in the business, media and press and so forth about the flattening of the yield curve. What do we mean by that? Well, flattening of a yield curve means you take short-term interest rates rising while long-term interest rates either fall or rise more slowly than the rise in the short-term rates. So the spread between short-term and long-term narrows. It flattens the curve. If you had two curves, right, one for long-term rates, one for short-term rates, you would see the gap between them shortening or narrowing. Well, what that reflects is while the Federal Reserve and other forces are driving up short-term rates, the longer-term perspective by investors is that the economy is going to weaken, and therefore longer-term rates start slowing or even declining while short-term rates keep rising. And this is the fundamental point. The yield curve, when it flattens, when the two curves are equal, or sometimes the long term even dips below the short term. When that happens, we have always had a recession. Always. It's maybe the number one predictor of recessions, the yield curve. That yield curve is narrowing. Some say by 2019, they will converge, and that will be an indicator of what's going on in the economy in terms of imminent recession. And I've been saying 2019 is recession USA. All right. And the yield curve will help predict that. And we'll see. And we say the yield curve, what we're talking about is, 2-year T bonds and bills and 10-year T bonds and bills. But you can look at it in other ways as well. Pick a different benchmark rate, the federal funds rate, maybe, or whatever. Short-term rates and long-term rates, but typically it's the 2-year and the 10-year. All right, so let's keep that in mind, and we will watch that yield curve as it flattens. And certainly, if it inverts, long-term lower than short-term, definitely a recession immediately. Immediately, I think the yield curve will not. We won't have to wait until it inverts. I think we not only will we not have to wait for the inversion, I think the conversion, the flattening of the two curves, even before that happens, we will fall into a recession here. Okay, let's move on. We've been talking about stock buybacks in previous shows and the frenzy going on now over $1.2 trillion in anticipated forecasted stock buybacks and dividend payouts this year, far more than ever before. We've been running $1 trillion a year for 5 or 6 years now. And that's money going to the wealthy elites, you see, because they own most of the stock. The top 5%, especially 1%, own the vast majority, 85, 90% of all the stock. So, they're getting all the money that's been produced in this so-called recovery. It's going to them in the U.S. we're talking about. Well, now you got offshore countries doing the same thing. I just saw an interesting report that a big stock buyback frenzy now occurring in Japan. Yeah, Japan too. How much? Well, in 2013, 2 trillion yen, that's the Japanese currency, were involved in stock buybacks. By 2016, it was 6 trillion yen. Last year, about 6 trillion as well, but this year, well above 6 trillion, maybe 6.5 trillion. A yen is about 1 penny to the dollar, I think. 110 yen to the dollar. So you do the math here, converting 6 trillion. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, right? Okay. It's spreading. They're flush with even more cash in Japan than they are in the United States. The investors class, in other words. Oh, but at the same time, despite all this cash, what's happening to the economy in Japan? Well, we just had data this past week. Japanese economy contracted, negative. In other words, another recession coming in Japan. And by the way, this is like the fourth or fifth recession since 2008-9 crash. Japan gets a very weak recovery and slips back into a double dip, a triple dip, and a quadruple dip, quadruple dip recession. Maybe this is quintuple, I don't know. Every year or so, back into recession, weak recovery, back into recession. Well, this is what I call the epic recession scenario in my 2010 book that I mentioned last week. Epic recessions are financial crashes that result in very weak, shallow recoveries for a short period of time, followed by another contraction that tends to be also weak and shallow, followed by a shallow recovery and another short, shallow downturn. In other words, bouncing up and down between no growth here over an extended period of time. That's an epic recession. And we've seen that here in the US in the 20th century, early 20th century, and we're seeing it in Japan. And then we're seeing a version of this not quite as weak in the Eurozone, in Europe as well. As now, the latest indication is that the growth in Germany and the Eurozone has halved. In other words, is barely growing. German growth last quarter, only 0.3%, 0.3%. It's almost flat. And Germany is a third of the Eurozone economy. Okay, so as Germany goes, so goes Europe. And Europe-wide GDP is reflecting that as well. In other words, it too is slowed down dramatically in one quarter. So we got Japan in recession and Europe almost in stagnation again, and a kind of a not as weak form of epic recession going on there. It hasn't really recovered. It had a bona fide significant double dip in 2011-13, and it's been bouncing along the bottom ever since, and now it looks like it's going to stagnate once again, right? So if you look at Japan, there's no growth in investment, no growth in consumption, and exports are declining, and that's why you've got a negative 0.6% decline in Japan GDP in the first quarter of this year, following a weak fourth quarter. And now we got the same thing going, although at a little higher growth rate in Europe. Same thing going there. Okay, so when is the U.S. going to follow suit? Well, the U.S. bought itself some time, you see, by this massive tax cut that's stimulating some investment, stimulating more buybacks and so forth. But the tax cuts are so massive, it's released some of the animal spirits, business confidence. So they are spending a little bit on capital goods that they hadn't been for 7 years now. Okay, so that's why we got this going on. Massive tax cuts boosting up business. Of course, a lot of debt being issued to households to buy the goods. But now the prices of the goods are going up too much, housing and so forth, and autos, and even the debt isn't going to work. Debt-driven consumption isn't going to do its magic as much as it had been doing here. Going forward, I believe, after the elections, you see, we're going to see a big retrenchment after the elections. They're going to keep it going here, pumping it up until the November elections. But after that, I believe that the economy is going to shift dramatically in the U.S. We'll certainly see and watch the trends between now and that time. Okay. All right. So Latin America about to explode economically. Japan in recession. Europe heading towards recession. Interest rates rising in the U.S., slowing down autos and construction. Yield curve beginning to flatten. What's another factor here? Oh, oil prices. Crude oil prices now up to $80 a barrel and more and rising. Whoa. What's that going to do? Well, it's certainly going to whack U.S. consumption, isn't it? Household consumption, you fill up your gas tank lately. In California, it's well over $4 a gallon, rising. It's going to continue to rise. They take advantage of the rise in the crude oil, the refiners, to pass it on and then raise even more. And then at the pump, at your station, local gas station, they take advantage of the rise in the refined gasoline, and they add on top of that. So everybody's beginning to gouge here in the whole chain, the supply chain here. And the consumer, the household is going to pay the price. He'll be paying more, significantly more for gasoline, which means he's going to pay spend significantly less on other things. And that's the reason why consumption is going to fade as well. You see, not only rising prices, for housing and rising prices for education still going on, but also now rising prices for gasoline is going to continue, and we're going to see that take a big whack out of household budgets, right? And at the same time, the cost of borrowing for big ticket items, cars and student loans and so forth is going up, so that will have a negative impact as well. People forget what $100 a barrel oil did and contributed to the 2008 crash. Maybe some will remember, but in that spring, when the credit system began to wobble in the U.S., Bear Stearns and Lehman and all the others began to weaken dramatically. When that began to happen, subprime mortgage market began to crack. When that began to happen, oil was at $120, $140 a barrel. Yeah, well, that took a big whack out of household income. And then they lost the jobs, a million a month, right, when the whole crash came. With a million jobs a month lost and $120, $50 a barrel oil and gasoline at more than $5 a gallon, well, the consumer just stopped consuming. And that resulted in a very deep contraction, or it certainly exacerbated the contraction that was already occurring. Well, what's behind $80 a barrel? And Bank of America forecast, by the way, it's going to go to 100 this summer. What's behind it? Well, the excuse is the breakdown of the deal with Iran and the U.S., which may have some effect on sanctions and therefore Iranian oil on the market. And then Argentina, not Argentina, rather, Venezuela, crisis, economic crisis in Venezuela, manufactured by the US, by the way, is going to drive up the shortages of oil, crude oil, and therefore drive up the price. Well, why is there a shortage in Argentina, which has the greatest reserves, even more than Saudi Arabia, of crude oil? Well, that's because the U.S. is doing every has been doing everything it can to sabotage and scuttle Argentine oil production. When oil refining and oil drilling is very high technology, and it's a heavy industry. It's lots of machine parts and so forth involved. And it takes a constant maintenance and repair. Well, what's happening in Argentina now is that this boycott of the U.S. Of Argentina trying to scuttle its economy has taken a toll on the maintenance and repair of its oil production. And as a result, some of the drilling and refining has to be cut back, because they haven't been able to repair and maintain a lot of this facilities that they have. Well, the U.S. wants that to happen because Argentina, I mean, excuse me once again, Venezuela, 95% of all its government income and revenue comes from the sale of oil. So if you can stop the sale of oil or reduce the sale of oil out of Venezuela, you're going to deny the government income. And also, you're going to raise the price of not only gasoline and oil, but of other commodities as well. You see, Venezuela has to import a lot. And if it doesn't have dollars from the sale of oil that is declining, right, it can't purchase hospital goods, medical goods, food, and so forth from abroad. And therefore, inflation goes up dramatically if they don't have dollars. Part of the U.S. strategy to sabotage Venezuela's economy has been, at the center, has been deny it dollar currency. The U.S. required U.S. companies that were doing business in Venezuela not to do it in dollars, to take dollars out of the country. And the U.S. even started through Colombia this speculative investing outlet here that could only be invested in dollars, so people in Venezuela that had dollars would invest it in Colombia. You see, they're doing everything they can in various ways, the U.S., to suck the dollars out of Venezuela. And then doing that, Venezuela doesn't have the hard currency to purchase imports. So the price of imports go through the roof, you see, and that destabilizes the government, causes the government support for the government for folks, who are suffering to turn against the government and to U.S. paid opposition groups of various kinds. This guy, I think his name is Falcon now, right? So they create a crisis in the economy. And the number one way of doing that is to deny these economies of currency, of dollar currency, in various ways. Well, if you have a collapse in the production of oil, and oil is 95% of government revenue, well, then they can't get the revenue. They can't get the dollars by selling their oil. And that's what's going on here in Venezuela, right? Allow their industrial oil producing plant to deteriorate, prevent any maintenance and repair of it by U.S. and boycott and other countries and other companies. If they want to do business, the French, if they want to do business with the U.S., then you better not do business with repairing the facilities in Venezuela, you see. So they get everybody to retreat. Now, the price of oil has been rising, right? And the prospect of Venezuela being able to get its way out of this crisis by selling more oil, more, you know, higher priced oil, kind of looked like Venezuela might recover here, right? But the higher price of global crude oil is being offset by the decline in the production of oil and this global sale of Venezuelan oil, you see. There's also talk, it's come across some sources that like Morales, the president there in Bolivia, had some information that the U.S. was planning with Colombia and some others to actually have a military invasion of Venezuela, if necessary. In other words, if this strategy of wrecking the economy does not produce the results they hope in the upcoming elections, in other words, if the Maduro government wins again, then you can see, you'll see, and oil continues to rise, then you're going to see a more likely possibility of actually a physical invasion. The U.S. will consider that its economic policy has not been able to overturn the government, and the strategies that it used to get U.S.-friendly businesses back in power in Argentina and Brazil will not work in Venezuela, so they're going to have to do something more direct. Okay, so we'll watch what's going on there, but we are on the verge of something very interesting, perhaps, in Venezuela politically. But keep in mind the collapse of the economy, which is never explained why the economy has collapsed in the American press and the corporate media. All it says is that, oh, it's terrible, and all these feature stories about how people are so terribly, conditions and so forth are so bad, et cetera. And then by inference or even directly, they blame the Maduro government, right? The Maduro government is just incompetent. Mm-hmm. No. The Maduro government, it's not the government that's incompetent. It's the U.S. policy to wreck the currency and prevent the sale of oil, to raise currency. That's what's behind the inflation and the contraction of the economy. The shortages. The shortages are because they don't have money, dollars, to buy these imports, right? So the price of the imports go up, and you get a fairly little of the imports coming in, and creates a black market and speculation and so forth, right? Okay, so enough on that, but we will keep watching that as well. All right, trade. Let's return back to trade here. Trade negotiations. We've been talking about these trade negotiations and writing about it. I will have a third in my series on this, print articles, appearing in about a week. You can read the first two, Trump's Phony Trade War, on my blog, jackrasmus.com, and/or you can read the second version, Is the U.S.-China Trade War for Real? These two articles express the dichotomy going on in U.S. trade policy right now. And that dichotomy is basically go light and easy on U.S. trade allies, create an impression that Trump is doing something about this, but don't change very much. You see, just tweak it. Tweak NAFTA, tweak the deal with Europe. We saw them tweak the deal with South Korea. Nothing significant, but create some messaging that you can take, Trump can take to his domestic base and say, look what I'm doing about all these foreigners, right, that have been ripping us off, which really isn't very much he's been doing and he won't be doing. Okay, so that's one track of the dichotomy in the U.S. trade, quote, war, which isn't a trade war. Going on, and the other one is the attitude towards China, and the sort of tit for tat, sometimes harsh, sometimes conciliatory going on between the two. As I said in this article, there are three objectives for the U.S. in its negotiations, which it's serious about with China. Not serious with the rest, with NAFTA. Three things. One, they want to stop technology transfer because 5G and artificial intelligence and cybersecurity are all heavily military and next generation technology for military conflict. And China is sucking the technology out of U.S. companies as a condition of doing business in China, and it's on the move to try to purchase U.S. companies that have key elements of related to these technologies as well. And what you see is going on is a series of moves in the last month by the U.S. to block Chinese companies from obtaining technology. We've talked about the ZTE Corporation here, a Chinese company, and how it's been pretty much undermined and prevented from making acquisitions or even dealing with trade for essential things it needs for its cell phones and so forth. It's a wireless telecom company in China. While the U.S. has stopped that in its tracks, there are other attempts of China to acquire companies or partner with companies, et cetera, which have been frozen in the U.S. And now, just this past week, the U.S. Congress is passing a legislation, you see, wants to get in on the act to prevent China acquisitions. Well, China has been responding, at least initially, in turn, putting limits on or holding up acquisitions of U.S. companies of technology of other companies, not even necessarily in China, but to get the okay to continue business in China, the acquisitions, they have to get China government approval as well. A good example is Qualcomm, a U.S. chip company that's deep into wireless and new stuff coming. As well. Well, you know, they want to purchase this NDX or NXP, excuse me, NXP company in Europe, which is leading edge in certain areas of tech. But Qualcomm sells a lot of stuff into China, chips. So China is holding up the approval of the acquisition of Qualcomm of NXP, you see. It can play that game too. Well, there's a lot of that going on behind the scenes, you see, maneuvering, preventing the acquisition. Well, that all reflects the number one goal of the U.S., I have been saying, which is a slow down technology transfer of China for military reasons and industrial reasons as well. Slow it down. Well, the other objectives of the U.S. and China are to open up the markets to U.S. companies, particularly U.S. bankers. You know, they've always wanted to get into China and get a deeper hold in China because it's a 1.3 billion population, and more cars are being sold in China now than in the U.S. So they want to get in there, and they want to finance it and charge their fees and so forth. But China up until now has had a rule that no company can own more than 49% of a Chinese company. Well, you know, number one demand for bankers in these trade negotiations with China is to up that. Well, China's already agreed to 51% and said it'll go to 100%, you know, if you guys play ball with us. So, you know, the banking interests are really interested in that in the U.S. And, you know, the U.S. trade team that went to China here a week or so ago was composed of three interest groups. You know, one was the military, represented by Peter Navarro and Lighthizer, Robert Lighthizer, and then the bankers, represented by Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, who was an ex-CEO, I believe, or president of Goldman Sachs, right? So he represents the bankers on that team. And than Larry Kudlow, who represents Trump. You know what Trump wants out of all this trade negotiations is something to boast about to his political base in the Midwest. That's what he wants, and I think he'll take whatever he needs create an argument. See what I did? Yeah, even though he's going to exaggerate and lie about it. He'll say, see what I did to his base. This is his old economic nationalism, America first theme that got him into office in the first place. He's resurrecting that. So what Trump wants is to show something, right? And what the U.S. military wants is stop tech transfer. And what the bankers want is more access and other multinational companies, more access. Well, you know, if you watch the press and the statements of Trump in particular, it's hard to say whether there really is a trade war going on or a trade deal in the making, because Trump will say one thing out of one side of his mouth and something out of the other side. He'll sound tough on something. He's pandering to his base. And then he'll sound conciliatory on something else. Oh, we like the Chinese, or he'll praise Chinese President Xi or something like that. And then he'll turn around and he'll say something nasty about the Chinese publicly. Well, that's for his base consumption, you see. I think the guy's an opportunist. He just wants something. And he's not driving the negotiations, by the way. You would think he is. He's the president, but he's not. Who's driving the negotiations? I think now, this past week, we see it's the bankers. It's Steve Mnuchin, who now heads up the trade team. It used to be Lighthizer, who was a hardliner on China, and Peter Navarro, advisor on trade to Trump, who was even a harder hardliner, see? But what's happened this past week is that Navarro is out. He's no longer on the team. And who's heading up the team? It's Steve Mnuchin, right? Ex-CEO Goldman Sachs, now Treasury Secretary. And he's been saying some nice things about the deal so far. In other words, the bankers are going to get what they want. They're going to get more access. That's what they want out of the trade negotiations. Yeah. And other companies will get more access too. Auto companies, U.S. auto companies, will get to sell more in China because they're not able to sell as much anymore, and it's declining in North America. That's what's going on. All right. Now, the third thing is to show some gain on the trade deficit, which is, you know, $337 billion net trade deficit. The U.S. has a $375 billion goods deficit. In other words, we export $375 billion less to China than they import to us, or exports to us, however you want to say it, right? Okay. And we run a surplus with China on services of about $40 billion, somewhere around there, right? So what Kudlow and Trump want is to say, oh, we reduced imports from China, or we increased exports from the U.S. to China. Well, I think what you're going to see is China is going to agree to buy more U.S. goods. That's what they're going to do. And there might be some token decline in Chinese exports to the U.S. So the trade deficit with China should go down by some several tens of billions. And Trump will say, oh, look what I did. Big deal, right? But in exchange for that, bankers, U.S. bankers and multinationals are going to get a deeper position in China. That's what they really want. And maybe we'll see something on tech transfer limitations. But the Chinese are going to be hard-nosed on the tech transfer, you see. But maybe the bankers and Trump will, quote, take the money and run on a deal on access and purchases of U.S. goods, and won't fight over the tech transfer. And that was to take a short-term solution at a long-term cost for the U.S. And I think the Chinese are playing that game. You know, they're really stroking Mnuchin and the bankers and the auto companies and so forth. And they're talking about they might buy several tens of billions more. Trump wants them to buy 200 billion more of U.S. goods. Well, that's almost impossible, but that's his bargaining position. See, all Trump wants is to put his imprimatur on these deals. That's what he wants. You know, he runs for office and he says, "I'm going to get rid of NAFTA. I'm going to do this and that." Right? Nah. All he wants to do is say, "Look, I renegotiated the deal, and what a good negotiator I am." Of course, it'll be very minor stuff, but he'll blow it out of proportion, lie about it, exaggerate it, make it look like, you know, he's the big negotiator. And before people realize that nothing's really happened, you'll have an election. See, that's what it's all about. Okay, so China trade war, I don't think so. 60-40, I don't think so. I think they'll reach a deal here, but you never know. The hardliners could reinsert themselves here, just as they're doing in the political negotiations with North Korea, right? The hardliners insisted on this what military exercises, because they knew it was going to piss off North Korea, and now North Korea may back out of the deal. I don't think Trump even ever wants to deal with North Korea. He wants to make it look like it, but the U.S. elites and the South Korean military and others, they don't want a deal either. And I don't think we're going to see a deal on Korea, right? And that's okay with the military sector of the elites in this country and their ally elites in South Korea and elsewhere. That's okay. They don't care if there's no deal. But it's all a show going on now, right? Okay. Now, an interesting thing I also read here, I had to laugh at reading it, was that Google suggests that we can reduce the trade deficit of the US, particularly with China, by simply redefining what we mean by a deficit. You know, what's that all about? Right? Well, you know, the US, when it can't solve a problem, it redefines it away oftentimes. That's what Bill Clinton did. And at the end of his administration, he redefined the 50 million without insurance to drop it to 45 million. In other words, by redefining what it meant to be without health insurance, he took 5 million people off of the rolls of uninsured, right? George W. Bush, to reduce inflation, they created a new estimate of inflation. Instead of the CPI, we got the chained CPI. And as we smooth out year to year the CPI, and the actual inflation rate is less. Under Obama, we redefined what gross domestic product was. And in doing that, we added $500 billion a year to GDP. Well, we grew the economy 0.3 of 1% every year since, right? And retroactive as well, going back, simply by redefining what goes into GDP. We added the stuff that previously was not considered something that would be added to GDP, like logos, the value of logos and trademarks, right? Intellectual property. Well, you know, it's all guesswork what that stuff is worth, but you exaggerate it and you add it to GDP as part of investment, which it really isn't. Well, we got the same proposal here by Google. What Google is saying is that we should count intermediate goods in GDP, particularly software that goes into like cell phones or whatever. You know, the convention for estimating GDP is what's the final good sale, not all the content that goes in it along the stage of developing it, but what's the final cost, market cost, and the sale of it, final goods, in other words. That's the only thing that counts, final goods. Well, what Google is saying, well, let's break that convention and let's consider intermediate software that goes into these cell phones, and that will reduce the cost Well, actually, it will boost GDP, and of course, it will mean that it will lower. Well, it will boost our exports, the value of our exports, and therefore reduce our trade deficit. Yeah, intermediate goods. Well, how much would this do? Well, as Google estimates, we could reduce our trade deficit by $200 billion a year. In other words, we could cut it in a third or in half simply by redefining it away. That's the proposal. Watch it happen. Yeah, you won't hear much about that. But they do that all the time, right? They redefine. If they can't solve the problem with real policy, they just redefine the problem away in whole or part. And that's what we're seeing here with this proposal by Google. Watch them adopt that, I predict. All right. The last thing I want to talk about here is the drug industry, prescription drugs, you know. By the way, that's another thing gouging everybody, right? Price increases for oil and gas and interest rates and just about everything else going on, and the drug industry gouging everybody. Well, Trump came on TV here, I think it was, or certainly at a press conference a week or so ago, saying, oh, he's going to do something about all these runaway drug prices, right? He's going to do something about it, right? Just as he said, he's going to do something about NAFTA and autos, right? Make sure that they produce so much content of U.S. autos in the U.S. Well, he's backed off of that. And he said, no, we don't have to do that. Just make sure they raise the wages of Mexican workers. That's supposed to be a solution? No. Long as the wages of Mexican workers aren't equal to the wages and other costs of American workers, they'll keep producing in Mexico. That's just a cover-up. NAFTA cover up, and it shows the U.S. retreat on NAFTA and its softball approach. Well, the same thing's going with the prescription drug sector, and it's a phony deal that he's proposing, and we'll talk about that more next week. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.